the fourth morning. For the desk of... But we don't really need these formalities anymore, do we, Mr. Jabal? We know each other by now. Plus, we don't have the time for formalities, I'm afraid. It'll be a short session today, Mr. Premier. I was listening to a program on the radio about this man called Castro, who threw the rich out of his country and freed his people. I love listening to programs about great men, and before I knew it, it had turned to 2 a.m. I wanted to hear more about this Castro, but for your sake I've turned the radio off. I'll resume the story exactly where we left off. Oh, democracy! Now, Mr. Premier, the little take-home pamphlet that you will be given by the Prime Minister will no doubt contain a very large section on the splendour of democracy in India, the awe-inspiring spectacle of 1 billion people casting their votes to determine their own future in full freedom of franchise, and so on and so forth. I gather you yellow-skinned men, despite your triumphs in sewage, drinking water, and Olympic gold medals, still don't have democracy. Some politician on the radio was saying that that's why we Indians are going to beat you. We may not have sewage, drinking water, and Olympic gold medals, but we do have democracy. If I were making a country, I'd get the sewage pipes first, then the democracy, then I'd go about giving pamphlets and statues of Gandhi to other people. But what do I know? I'm just a murderer. I've got no problem with democracy, Mr. Jabal. Far from it. I owe democracy a lot. Even my birthday, in fact. This was back in the days when I was smashing coals and wiping tables at the tea shop in Laxmangar. There was a clapping from the direction of the portrait of Gandhi. The old tea shop owner began shouting that all his workers had to leave whatever they were doing and march to the school. A man in a government uniform sat at the teacher's desk in the schoolroom with a long book and black pen, and he was asking everyone two questions. Name?
Balram Halway.
Age?
No age.
No date of birth?
No, sir. My parents didn't make note of it.
He looked at me and said, I think you're 18. I think you turned 18 today. You just forgot, didn't you?
I bowed to him.
That's correct, sir. I forgot. It was my birthday today.
Good boy.
And then he wrote that down in his book and told me to go away. So I got a birthday from the government. I had to be 18. All of us in the tea shop had to be 18, the legal age to vote. There was an election coming up, and the tea shop owner had already sold us. He had sold our fingerprints, the inky fingerprints which the illiterate person makes on the ballot paper to indicate his vote. I had overheard this from a customer. This was supposed to be a close election. He had got a good price for each one of us from the Great Socialist's party. Now, the Great Socialist had been the boss of the darkness for a decade at the time of this election. His party symbol, a pair of hens breaking through handcuffs, symbolizing the poor, shaking off the rich, was imprinted in black stencils on the walls of every government office in the darkness. Some of the customers at the tea shop said the Great Socialist started off as a good man. He had come to clean things up, but the mud of Mother Ganga had sucked him in. Others said he was dirty from the start, but he had just fooled everyone. And only now did we see him for what he was. Whatever the case was, no one seemed able to vote him out of power. He had ruled the darkness, winning election after election, but now his rule was weakening. You see, a total of 93 criminal cases for murder, rape, grand larceny, gun running, pimping, and many other such minor offences are pending against the Great Socialist and his ministers at the present moment. Not easy to get convictions when the judges are judging in darkness, yet 3 convictions have been delivered, and 3 of the ministers are currently in jail but continue to be ministers. The Great Socialist himself is said to have embezzled 1 billion rupees from the darkness and transferred that money into a bank account in a small, beautiful country in Europe full of white people and black money. Now that the date for the elections had been set, and declared on radio, election fever had started spreading again,
These are the three main diseases of this country, sir. Typhoid, cholera, and election fever. This last one is the worst. It makes people talk and talk about things that they have no say in. The great socialists' enemies seem to be stronger this election than at the last one. They had made pamphlets and went about on buses and trucks with microphones and announced they were going to topple him over and drag the river Ganga and everyone who lived on its banks out of the darkness and into the light. At the tea shop, the gossip grew furious. People sipped their tea and discussed the same things again and again. Would they do it this time? Would they beat the great socialist and win the elections? Had they raised enough money of their own and bribed enough policemen and bought enough fingerprints of their own to win? Like eunuchs discussing the Kama Sutra, the voters discussed the elections in Laxmangar. One morning I saw a policeman writing a slogan on the wall outside the temple with a red paintbrush. Do you want good roads, clean water, good hospitals? Then vote out the great socialist. For years there was a deal between the landlords and the great socialist. Everyone in the village knew about this. But this year something had gone wrong with the deal, so the four animals had joined together and started a party of their own. And below the slogan, the policeman wrote, All India Social Progressive Front Leninist Faction, which was the name of the landlord's party. In the weeks before the elections, trucks bumped up and down the dirty streets of Laxmangar, full of young men holding microphones. Stand up to the rich! Vijay, the bus conductor, was always on one of these trucks. He had quit his old job and joined politics now. That was the thing about Vijay. Each time you saw him, he had done better for himself. He was a born politician. He wore a red headband to show that he was one of the great socialist supporters and made speeches every morning in front of the tea shop. The landlords brought in trucks full of their own supporters in retaliation, and from these trucks men shouted out, Roads, water, hospitals, vote out the great socialist. A week before the elections, both sides stopped sending out their trucks. I heard what had happened while cleaning up a table. The animal's bluff had worked. The great socialist had agreed to cut a deal with them. Vijay bowed down and touched the feet of the stork at a big rally in front of the tea shop. It seemed that all differences had been patched, and the stork had been named the president of the Laxmangar branch of the great socialist's party. Vijay was to be his deputy. Now the rallies were done. The priest celebrated a special puja to pray for the great socialist's victory. Mutton biryani was distributed on paper plates in front of the temple, and in the evening there was free hooch for all. Lots of dust and policemen came into the village next morning. One officer read out voting instructions in the marketplace. Whatever was being done for our own good. The great socialists' enemies would try and steal the election from us, the poor, and take the power away from us, the poor, and put those shackles back on our hands that he, the great socialist, had so lovingly taken off our hands. Did we understand? And then, in a cloud of dust, the police drove off. It's the way it always is, my father told me that night. I've seen 12 elections, 5 general, 5 state, 2 local, and someone else has voted for me 12 times. I've heard that people in the other India get to vote for themselves. Isn't that something? On the day of the election, one man went mad. This happens every time at every election in the darkness. One of my father's colleagues, a small dark-skinned man whom no one had taken any notice of until now, was surrounded by a mob of rickshaw pullers, including my father. They were trying to dissuade him, but only half-heartedly. They had seen this thing happening before. They wouldn't be able to stop this man now. Every now and then, even in a place like Laxmangar, a ray of sunlight will break through. All these posters and speeches and slogans on the wall, maybe they get into a man's head. He declares himself a citizen of the democracy of India and he wants to cast his vote. That was where this rickshaw puller had got to. He declared himself free of the darkness. He had made his Benares that day. He began walking straight to the voting booth at the school. "I'm supposed to stand up to the rich, aren't I?" he shouted. "Isn't that what they keep telling us?" When he got there, the great socialist supporters had already put up the tally of votes outside on a blackboard. They had counted 2,341 votes in that booth. Everyone had voted for the great socialist. Vijay, the bus conductor, was up on a ladder, hammering into the wall a banner with the great socialist symbol, the hands breaking their shackles. The slogan on the banner said, "Congratulations to the great socialist on his unanimous victory from Laxmangar." Vijay dropped the hammer, the nails, and the banner when he saw the rickshaw puller. "What are you doing here?" "Voting," he shouted back. "Isn't it the election today?" I cannot confirm what happened next, even though I was only a few feet behind him. A big crowd had gathered to watch him from a distance. But when the policeman charged at us, we turned and ran in a stampede, so I never saw what they did to that brave, mad man. I heard about it the next day, while pretending to scratch a dirty spot out of a tabletop. Vijay and a policeman had knocked the rickshaw puller down, and they had begun beating him. They hit him with their sticks, and when he thrashed at them, they kicked him. They took turns. Vijay hit him, and the policeman stamped on his face, and then Vijay did it again. And after a while, the body of the rickshaw puller stopped wriggling and fighting back, but they kept stamping on him, until he had been stamped back into the earth. If I may go back for a moment to that wanted poster, Your Excellency, being called a murderer, fine, I have no objection to that. It's a fact. I am a sinner, a fallen human. But to be called a murderer by the police... what a fucking joke! Here's a little souvenir of your Indian visit to keep with you. Balaram Halwe is a vanished man, a fugitive, someone whose whereabouts are unknown to the police, right? Ha! The police know exactly where to find me. They will find me dutifully voting on election day at the voting booth in the school compound in Laxmangar in Gaya district, as I have done in every general, state and local election since I turned 18. I am India's most faithful voter, and I still have not seen the inside of a voting booth. Now, though the elections were due soon in Dhanbad, life went on as ever within the high walls of the Stork's house. He sighed as his legs were pressed in warm water. Games of cricket and badminton went on around him, and I washed and cleaned the two Pomeranian dogs faithfully. Then one day a familiar face turned up at the gate. Vijay, the bus conductor from Laxmangar, my childhood hero, had a new uniform this time. He was dressed all in white, and wore a white Nehru cap on his head, and had rings of solid gold on 8 of his fingers. Public service had been good to him. I waited by the gate and watched. The stork himself came out to see Vijay and bowed down before him, a landlord bowing down before a pig-herd's son. The marvels of democracy. 2 days later, the great socialist came to the house. The entire household was abuzz because of the visit. Mr. Ashok stood at the gate, waiting with a garland of jasmine flowers. His brother and his father were by his side. A car came to the gate. Its door opened, and then the face I had seen on a million election posters since I was a boy emerged. I saw the puffy cheeks, the spiky white hair, the thick gold earrings. Vijay was wearing his red headband today, and holding up the flag with the breaking shackle symbol. He shouted, "Long live the great socialist!" The great man folded his palms and bowed all around him. He had one of those either-or faces that all great Indian politicians have. This face says that it is now at peace, and you can be at peace too, if you follow the owner of that face. But the same face can also say, with a little twitch of its features, that it has known the opposite of peace, and it can make this other fate yours too, if it so wishes. Mr. Ashok put the garland on the great man's thick, bull-like neck. "My son," the stork said, "returned from America recently." The great socialist squeezed Mr. Ashok's cheeks. "Good. We need more boys to come back and build India into a superpower. And then they went into the house, and all the doors and windows were closed. After a while, the great socialist came out into the courtyard, followed by the old man, the mongoose, and Mr. Ashok. I was trying to overhear them, and so pretended to be sweeping the ground, while inching closer and closer to them. I had swept myself right into hearing distance, when the great socialist tapped me on the back. "What's your name, son?" he asked. Then he said, "Your employers are trying to bugger me, Balram. What do you say to this?" Mr. Ashok looked stunned. The stork simpered. "A million and a half is a lot, sir. We'll be happy to come to a settlement with you." The great socialist waved his hands as if dismissing that plea. "Bullshit. You've got a good scam going here, taking coal for free from the government mines. You've got it going because I let it happen. You were just some little village landlord when I found you. I brought you here. I made you what you are today. And by God, you cross me and you'll go back there into that village. I said a million and a fucking half, and I mean a million and..." He had to stop. He had been chewing pan, and now his mouth had filled up with red spittle, which was beginning to dribble out. He turned to me and made the shape of a bowl with his hands. I rushed to the Honda City to get the spittoon. When I came back with the spittoon, he coolly turned to the mongoose and said, "Son, won't you hold the spittoon for me?" The mongoose refused to move, so the great socialist took the spittoon from my hands and held it out. "Take it, son." The mongoose took it. Then the great socialist spat into the spittoon 3 times. The mongoose's hands trembled. His face turned black with shame. "Thank you for that, son," the great socialist said, wiping his lips. He turned to me and tickled his forehead. "Where was I now?" There you have it. That was the positive side of the great socialist. He humiliated all our masters. That's why we kept voting him back in. That night, on the pretext again of sweeping the courtyard, I got close to the stork and his sons. They were sitting on a bench, holding glasses of golden liquor and talking. Mukesh Sir had just finished. The old man shook his head. "We can't do that, Mukesh. We need him." "I'm telling you, father, we don't anymore. We can go straight to Delhi. We know people there now." "I agree with Mukesh, father. We shouldn't let him treat us like this anymore, like we're his slaves." "Quiet, Ashok. Let Mukesh and me discuss this." I swept the courtyard twice over and listened. Then I began tightening Pinky Madam's sagging badminton net so I could stay near them. But a pair of suspicious Nepali eyes spotted me out. "Don't loiter in the courtyard. Go and sit in your room and wait for the masters to call you." "All right." Ram Bahadur glared at me, so I said, "All right, sir." Servants, incidentally, are obsessed with being called sir by other servants, sir. The next morning, when I was blow-drying puddles and cuddles after having shampooed them, Ram Bahadur came up to me and said, "Have you ever been to Delhi?" I shook my head. "They're going to Delhi in a week. Mr. Ashok and Pinky Madam, they're going to leave for 3 months. I got down on my knees and directed the blow-dryer under Cuddles' legs, pretending not to be interested, and asked as casually as I could, "Why?" The Nepali shrugged. "Who knew? We were just servants." One thing, though, he did know. "Only one driver will be taken along, and this driver will get 3,000 rupees a month. That's how much they'll pay him in Delhi." The blow-dryer fell out of my hand. "Serious? 3,000? "Yes." "Will they take me along, sir?" I got up and asked pleadingly. "Can't you make them take me?" "They'll take Ram Prasad," he said with a sneer of his Nepali lips. "Unless..." "Unless?" He minted coins with his fingers. 5,000 rupees. And he would tell the stork that I was the man to be taken along to Delhi. 5,000? Where will I get such money? My family steals my whole paycheck. Oh, well, in that case, it'll be Rampersad. As for you, he pointed to Cuddles and Puddles. You'll be cleaning the dogs for the rest of your life, I guess.
I woke up, both nostrils burning. It was still dark. Rampersad was up. He was sitting on his bed, chopping onions on a wooden board. I heard the tuck, tuck, tuck of his knife hitting the board. What the hell is he chopping onions so early for? I thought, turning to a side and closing my eyes again. I wanted to go back to sleep, but the tuck, tuck, tuck of the knife hitting the board insisted. This man had a secret. I stayed awake while the man on the bed chopped onions. I tried to figure it out. What had I noticed about Rampersad in the past few days? For one thing, his breath had gone bad. Even Pinky Madam complained. He had suddenly stopped eating with us, either inside the house or outside. Even on Sundays when there would be chicken, Rampersad would refuse to eat with us, saying he had already done so, or he wasn't hungry, or... The chopping of the onions continued, and I kept adding thought to thought in the dark. I watched him all day. Toward evening, as I was expecting, he began moving to the gate. From my conversation with the cook, I had learned that Rampersad had started to head out of the house at the same time every evening. I followed at a distance. He went into a part of the city I had never seen before, and walked around a few alleys. At one point I distinctly saw him turn around, as if to make sure no one was following him. Then he darted. He had stopped in front of a two-story building. The wall had a large metal grill divided into square units. A series of small black taps jutted out from the wall below the grill. He bent down to a tap, washed his face and gargled and spat. Then he took off his sandals. Shoes and sandals had been folded and stuffed into the squares of the grill. He did the same with his sandals. Then he went into the building and closed the door. I slapped my forehead. What a fool I'd been! It's Ramadan. They can't eat and drink during the day. I ran back to the house and found the Nepali. He was standing at the gate, rubbing his teeth with a twig broken from a neem tree, which is what many poor people in my country do, Mr. Premier, when they want to clean their teeth. I just saw a film, sir. Fuck off. A great film, sir. Lots of dancing. Hero was a Muslim. Name of Muhammad Muhammad. Don't waste my time, boy. Go clean the car if you've got nothing to do. Now, this Muhammad Muhammad was a poor, honest, hard-working Muslim, but he wanted a job at the home of an evil, prejudiced landlord who didn't like Muslims. So just to get a job and feed his starving family, he claimed to be a Hindu and took the name of Rampersad. The twig fell out of the Nepali's mouth. And you know how he managed to pull this off? Because the Nepali guard at this house, whom the masters trusted absolutely, and who was supposed to check up on Rampersad's background, was in on the scam. Before he could run, I caught him by the collar. Technically, in these servant-versus-servant affairs, that is all you need to do to indicate, I have won. But if you're going to do these things, it's better to do them in style, right? So I slapped him too. I was servant number one from now on in this household. I ran back to the mosque. Namaz must have ended by now. And indeed, Rampersad, or Muhammad, or whatever his name really was, came out of the mosque, took his sandals down from the window, slapped them on the ground, wriggled his feet into them, and began walking out. He saw me. I winked at him, and he knew that the game was up. I did the needful in a few precise words. Then I went back to the house. The Nepali was watching me from behind the black bars. I took his keychain from him and put it in my pocket. Get me some tea and biscuits. I pinched his shirt. And I want your uniform, too. Mine is getting old. I slept in the bed that night. In the morning, someone came into the room. It was ex-driver number one. Without a word to me, he began packing. All his things fitted into one small bag. I thought, what a miserable life he's had, having to hide his religion, his name,
just to get a job as a driver. And he is a good driver, no question of it. A far better one than I will ever be. Part of me wanted to get up and apologize to him right there and say, "You go and be a driver in Delhi. You never did anything to hurt me. Forgive me, brother." I turned to the other side, farted, and went back to sleep. When I woke up, he was gone. He had left all his images of gods behind, and I scooped them into a bag. You never know when those things can come in handy. In the evening, the Nepali came to me with a grin on his face. The same fake servant's grin he showed to the stork all day long. He told me that since Ram Prasad had left their service without a word, I would be driving Mr. Ashok and Pinky Madam to Delhi. He had personally and forcefully recommended my name to the stork. I went back to my bed, all mine now, stretched out on it and said, "Great. Now clean those webs off the ceiling, won't you?" He glared at me but said nothing and went away to get a broom. I shouted, "Sir!" From then on, every morning, it was hot Nepali tea and some nice sugar biscuits on a porcelain platter. Kishan came to the gate that Sunday and heard the news from me. I thought he was going to bugger me now for how abruptly I had left them at the village, but he was overcome with joy. His eyes were full of tears. Someone in his family was going to make it out of the darkness and into New Delhi. "It's just like our mother always said. She knew you were going to make it." 2 days later, I was driving Mr. Ashok, the mongoose, and Pinky Madam to Delhi in the Honda City. It wasn't hard to find the way. I just had to follow the buses. For there were buses and jeeps all along the road, and they were bursting with passengers, who packed the insides and hung out the doors and even got on the roofs. They were all headed from the darkness to Delhi. You'd think the whole world was migrating. Every time we passed by one of these buses, I had to grin. I wished I could roll down the window and yell at them, "I'm going to Delhi in a car, an air-conditioned car." But I'm sure they saw the words in my eyes. Around noon, Mr. Ashok tapped me on the shoulder. "From the start, sir, there was a way in which I could understand what he wanted to say, the way dogs understand their masters. I stopped the car and then moved to my left, and he moved to his right, and our bodies passed each other, so close that the stubble on his face scraped my cheeks like the shaving brush that I use every morning, and the cologne from his skin, a lovely, rich, fruity cologne, rushed into my nostrils for a heady instant, while the smell of my servant's sweat rubbed off onto his face, and then he became driver, and I became passenger. He started the car. The mongoose, who had been reading a newspaper the whole time, now saw what had happened. "Don't do this, Ashok." He was an old schoolmaster, the mongoose. He knew right from wrong. "You're right. This feels weird," Mr. Ashok said. The car came to a stop. Our bodies crossed each other again. Our scents were exchanged once more, and I was again the driver and servant, and Mr. Ashok was again the passenger and master. We reached Delhi late at night. It is not yet 3. I could go on a little while longer, but I want to stop, because from here on I have to tell you a new kind of story. Remember, Mr. Premier, the first time, perhaps as a boy, when you opened the hood of a car and looked into its entrails? Remember the coloured wires twisting from one part of the engine to the other? The black box, full of yellow caps, enigmatic tubes hissing out steam and oil and grease everywhere? Remember how mysterious and magical everything seemed? When I peer into the portion of my story that unfolds in New Delhi, I feel the same way. If you ask me to explain how one event connects to another, or how one motive strengthens or weakens the next, or how I went from thinking this about my master to thinking that, I will tell you that I myself don't understand these things. I cannot be certain that the story, as I will tell it, is the right story to tell. I cannot be certain that I know exactly why Mr. Ashok died. It will be good for me to stop here. When we meet again at midnight, remind me to turn the chandelier up a bit. The story gets much darker from here.
The fourth night. I should like to talk a little more about this chandelier.
Why not? I've got no family anymore. All I've got is chandeliers.
I have a chandelier here above my head in my office, and then I have two in my apartment in Raj Mahal Villas Phase 2, one in the drawing room and a small one in the toilet, too. It must be the only toilet in Bangalore with a chandelier. I saw all these chandeliers one day, tied to the branch of a big banyan tree near Lal Bagh Gardens. A boy from a village was selling them, and I bought all of them on the spot. I paid some fellow with a bullock cart to bring them home, and we went riding through Bangalore, me and this fellow and four chandeliers on a limousine powered by bulls. It makes me happy to see a chandelier. Why not? I'm a free man. Let me buy all the chandeliers I want. For one thing, they keep the lizards away from this room. It's the truth, sir. Lizards don't like the light, so as soon as they see a chandelier, they stay away. I don't understand why other people don't buy chandeliers all the time and put them up everywhere. Free people don't know the value of freedom. That's the problem. Sometimes in my apartment, I turn on both chandeliers, and then I lie down amid all that light, and I just start laughing. A man in hiding, and yet he's surrounded by chandeliers. There, I'm revealing the secret to a successful escape. The police searched for me in darkness, but I hid myself in light. In Bangalore. Now, among the many uses of a chandelier, the most unsung and unloved object is that when you forget something, all you have to do is stare at the glass pieces shining in the ceiling long enough, and within 5 minutes you'll remember exactly what it is you were trying to remember. See, I'd forgotten where we left off the story last night, so I had to go on about chandeliers for a while, keeping you busy, but now I remember where we were. Delhi. We had got to Delhi last night when I stopped the narrative. The capital of our glorious nation, the seat of Parliament, of the President, of all ministers and prime ministers, the pride of our civic planning, the showcase of the Republic. That's what they call it. Let a driver tell you the truth, and the truth is that Delhi is a crazy city. See, the rich people live in big housing colonies like Defence Colony, or Greater Kailash, or Vasant Kunj, and inside their colonies the houses have numbers and letters. But this numbering and lettering system follows no known system of logic. For instance, in the English alphabet, A is next to B, which everyone knows, even people like me who don't know English. But in a colony, one house is called A231, and the next is F378. So one time, Pinky Madam wanted me to take her to Greater Kailash E231. I tracked down the houses to E200, and just when I thought we were almost there, E block vanished completely. The next house was S something. Pinky Madam began yelling, "I told you not to bring this hick from the village." And then another thing. Every road in Delhi has a name like Aurangazeb Road, or Humayun Road, or Archbishop Makarios Road, and no one, masters or servants, knows the name of the road. You ask someone, "Where's Nikolai Copernicus Marg?" And he could be a man who lived on Nikolai Copernicus Marg his whole life, and he'll open his mouth and say, "Han?" Or he'll say, "Straight ahead, then turn left," even though he has no idea. And all the roads look the same. All of them go around and around grassy circles, in which men are sleeping or eating or playing cards, and then four roads shoot off from that grassy circle, and then you go down one road, and you hit another grassy circle where men are sleeping or playing cards, and then four more roads go off from it. So you just keep getting lost and lost and lost in Delhi. Thousands of people live on the sides of the road in Delhi. They have come from the darkness too. You can tell by their thin bodies, filthy faces, by the animal-like way they live under the huge bridges and overpasses, making fires and washing and taking lice out of their hair while the cars roar past them. These homeless people are a particular problem for drivers. They never wait for a red light, simply dashing across the road on impulse.
and each time I braked to avoid slamming the car into one of them, the shouting would start from the passenger's seat. But I ask you, who built Delhi in this crazy way? Which geniuses were responsible for making F block come after A block, and house number 69 come after house number 12? Who was so busy partying and drinking English liquor and taking their Pomeranian dogs for walks and shampoos that they gave the roads names that no one could remember? Are you lost again, driver? Don't go after him again. Why do you always defend him, Ashok? Don't we have more serious things to discuss? Why are we always talking about this driver? All right, let's discuss the other things then. First, let's discuss your wife and her temper tantrums. Do you really think that's more important than the tax thing? I keep asking you, what are we going to do about it, and you keep changing the topic. I think it's insane how much they're asking us to pay. I told you, it's a political thing. They're harassing us because father is trying to distance himself from the great socialist. I don't know why he ever got involved with that rogue. He got into politics because he had to, Ashok. You don't have a choice in the darkness. And don't panic. We can deal with this income tax charge. This is India, not America. There's always a way out here. I told you, we have someone here who works for us. Ramanathan. He's a good fixer. Ramanathan is a sleazy early cretin. We need a new tax lawyer, Mukesh. We need to go to the newspapers and tell them we're being raped by these politicians. Listen, the mongoose raised his voice. You just got back from America. Even this man driving a car knows more about India than you do right now. We need a fixer. He'll get us the interview with a minister that we need. That's how Delhi works. The mongoose leaned forward and put his hand on my shoulder. Lost again? Do you think you could find your way home this time without getting lost a dozen times? He sighed and fell back on his seat. We shouldn't have brought him here. He's hopeless. Ram Bahadur got it all wrong about this fellow. Ashok. Look up from your phone a minute. Have you told Pinky that you're staying back for good? Yes. What does the Queen say? Don't call her that. She's your sister-in-law, Mukesh. She'll be happy in Gurgaon. It's the most American part of the city. Now Mr. Ashok's thinking was smart. 10 years ago, they say, there was nothing in Gurgaon. Just water buffaloes and fat Punjabi farmers. Today it's the modernist suburb of Delhi. American Express, Microsoft, all the big American companies have offices there. The main road is full of shopping malls. Each mall has a cinema inside. So if Pinky Madam missed America, this was the best place to bring her. This moron, the mongoose said. See what he's done? He's got lost again. He stretched his hand and smacked my skull with it. Take a left from the fountain, you idiot. Don't you know how to get to the house from here? I began apologizing, but a voice from behind me said, It's all right, Balram. Just get us home. See, you're defending him again. Just put yourself in his place, Mukesh. Can you imagine how confusing Delhi must be to him? It must be like getting to New York for the first time was for me. The mongoose switched to English, and I didn't catch what he said. But Mr. Ashok replied in Hindi. Pinky thinks the same too. That's the only thing you and she agree on. But I won't have it, Mukesh. We don't know who's who in Delhi. This fellow, we can trust him. He's from home. At that moment, I looked at the rearview mirror, and I caught Mr. Ashok's eyes looking at me. And in those master's eyes, I saw the most unexpected emotion. Pity. How much are they paying you, country mouse? Enough. I'm happy. Not telling me, eh, country mouse? Good boy. A loyal servant to the end. Liking Delhi?
Yes.
Ha! Don't lie to me, sister fucker. I know you're completely lost here. You must hate it. He tried to put his hand on me, and I squirmed and moved back. He had a skin disease. Vitiligo had turned his lips bright pink in the middle of a pitch-black face. I'd better explain about this skin disease, which afflicts so many poor people in our country. I don't know why you get it, But once you do, your skin changes color from brown to pink. 9 cases out of 10, it's a few bright pink spots on a boy's nose or cheeks, like a star exploding on his face, or a rash of pink on the forearm, like someone burned him with boiling water there. But sometimes a fellow's whole body has changed color, and as you walk past, you think, an American. You stop to gape. You want to go near and touch. Then you realize it's just one of ours with that horrible condition. In the case of this driver, since the flash of pink had completely discolored his lips and nothing else, he looked like a clown at the circus with painted lips. My stomach churned just to see his face. Still, he was the only one of the drivers who was being nice to me, so I stayed close to him. We were outside the mall. We, a dozen or so chauffeurs, were waiting for our masters to finish their shopping. We weren't allowed inside the mall, of course. No one had to tell us these things. We had made a ring by the side of the parking lot, and we were smoking and chatting. Every now and then someone would emit a red jet of paan from his mouth. On account of the fact that he too was from the darkness, he had of course guessed my origin at once. The driver with the diseased lips gave me a course on how to survive Delhi and make sure I wasn't sent back to the darkness on the top of a bus. The main thing to know about Delhi is that the roads are good and the people are bad. The police are totally rotten. If they see you without a seatbelt, you'll have to bribe them 100 rupees. Our masters are not such a great lot either. When they go for their late-night parties, it's hell for us. You sleep in the car and the mosquitoes eat you alive. If they're malaria mosquitoes, it's all right. You'll just be raving for a couple of weeks. But if it's the dengue mosquitoes, then you're in deep shit and you'll die for sure. At 2 in the morning, he comes back, banging on the windows and shouting for you, and he's reeking of beer and he farts in the car all the way back. The cold gets really bad in January. If you know he's having a late-night party, take along a blanket so you can cover yourself in the car. Keeps the mosquitoes away, too. Now, you'll get bored sitting in the car and waiting for him to come back from his parties. I know one driver who went nuts from the waiting, so you need something to read. You can read, can't you? Good. This is the absolutely best thing to read in the car. He gave me a magazine with a catchy cover. A woman in her underwear was lying on a bed, cowering from the shadow of a man. Murder Weekly. ₹4.50. Exclusive true story. A good body never goes to waste. Murder, rape, revenge. Now I have to tell you about this magazine, Murder Weekly, since our Prime Minister certainly won't tell you anything about it. It's sold in every newsstand in the city, alongside the cheap novels, and it is very popular reading among all the servants of the city, whether they be cooks, children's maids, or gardeners. Drivers are no different. Every week when this magazine comes out, with a cover image of a woman cowering from her would-be murderer, some driver has bought the magazine and is passing it around to the other drivers. Now, don't panic at this information, Mr. Premier. No beads of chill sweat need form on your yellow brow. Just because drivers and cooks in Delhi are reading Murder Weekly, it doesn't mean that they are all about to slit their masters' necks. Of course, they'd like to. Of course, 1 billion servants are secretly fantasizing about strangling their bosses, and that's why the government of India publishes this magazine and sells it on the streets for just 4.5 rupees, so that even the poor can buy it. You see, the murderer in the magazine is so mentally disturbed and sexually deranged that not one reader would want to be like him, and in the end he always gets caught by some honest, hard-working police officer. Ha! Or goes mad and hangs himself by a bedsheet after writing a sentimental letter to his mother or primary school teacher, or is chased, beaten, buggered and garroted by the brother of the woman he has done in. So if your driver is busy flicking through the pages of Murder Weekly, relax. No danger to you. Quite the contrary. It's when your driver starts to read about Gandhi and the Buddha that it's time to wet your pants, Mr. Jabhao. After showing it to me, Vitiligo Lips closed the magazine and threw it into the circle where the other drivers were sitting. They made a grab for it, like a bunch of dogs rushing after a bone. He yawned and looked at me.
What does your boss do for a living, Country Mouse?
I don't know.
Being loyal or being stupid, Country Mouse? Where is he from?
Dunbad.
He's into coal, then. Probably here to bribe ministers. It's a rotten business, coal.
He yawned again.
I used to drive a man who sold coal. Bad, bad business. But my current boss is into steel, and he makes the coal men look like saints.
Where does he live?
I told him the name of our apartment block.
My master lives there, too.
We're neighbors.
He sidled right up to me. Without moving away, that would have been rude, I tilted my body as far as I could from his lips.
Country Mouse, does your boss...
He looked around and dropped his voice to a whisper. Need anything?
What do you mean?
Does your boss like foreign wine? I have a friend who works at a foreign embassy as a driver. He's got contacts there. You know the foreign wine, foreign embassy scam.
I shook my head.
The scam is this, Country Mouse. Foreign wine is very expensive in Delhi because it's taxed, but the embassies get it in for free. They're supposed to drink their wine, but they sell it on the black market. I can get him other stuff, too.
Does he want golf balls?
I've got people in the U.S. consulate who will sell me that.
Does he want women?
I can get that, too.
If he's into boys, no problem.
My master doesn't do these things. He's a good man.
The diseased lips opened up into a smile. Aren't they all?
He began whistling some Hindi film song. One of the drivers had begun reading out a story from the magazine. All the others had gone silent. I looked at them all for a while. I turned to the driver with the horrible pink lips and said, I've got a question to ask you.
All right. Ask. You know I'll do anything for you, Country Mouse.
This building, the one they call a mall, the one with the posters of women hanging on it, it's for shopping, right?
Right.
And that, I pointed to a shiny glass building to our left, is that also a mall? I don't see any posters of women hanging on it.
That's not a mall, Country Mouse. That's an office building.
They make calls from there to America.
What kind of calls?
I don't know. My master's daughter works in one of those buildings, too. I drop her off at 8 o'clock and she comes back at 2 in the morning. I know she makes pots and pots of money in that building because she spends it all day in the malls.
He leaned in close. The pink lips were just centimeters from mine.
Between the two of us, I think it's rather odd. Girls going into buildings late at night and coming out with so much cash in the morning.
He winked at me.
What else, Country Mouse?
You're a curious fellow.
I pointed to one of the girls coming out of the mall.
What about her, Country Mouse? You like her?
I blushed. Tell me, I said, don't the women in cities, like her, have hair in their armpits and on their legs? Like women in our villages? After half an hour, Mukesh Seer and Mr. Ashok and Pinky Madam came out of the mall with shopping bags. I ran ahead to take their bags from them and put them in the back of the car, and then closed the back and jumped into the driver's seat of the Honda City and drove them to their new home, which was up on the 13th floor of a gigantic apartment building. The name of the apartment building was Buckingham Towers B Block. It was next to another huge apartment building, built by the same housing company, which was Buckingham Towers A Block. Next to that was Windsor Manor A Block, and there were apartment blocks like this, all shiny and new, with nice big English names, as far as the eye could see. Buckingham Towers B Block was one of the best. It had a nice big lobby and an elevator in the lobby that all of us took up to the 13th floor. Personally, I didn't like the apartment much. The whole place was the size of the kitchen in Dunbar. There were nice soft white sofas inside, and on the wall above the sofas a giant framed photo of Cuddles and Puddles. The stork had not allowed them to come with us to the city. I couldn't stand to look at those creatures, even in a photograph, and kept my eyes to the carpet the whole time I was in the room, which had the additional benefit of giving me the look of a pukka servant. "Leave the bags anywhere you want, Balram."
"No, put them down next to the table. Put them down exactly there," the mongoose said.
After putting the bags down, I went into the kitchen to see if any cleaning needed to be done. There was a servant just to take care of the apartment, but he was a sloppy fellow, and as I said, they didn't really have a driver, just a servant who drove the car sometimes. I knew without being told, I also had to take care of the apartment. Any cleaning there was to be done, I would do, and then come back and wait near the door with folded hands until Mukesh Seer said, "You can go now, and be ready at 8 a.m. No hanky-panky just because you're in the city, understand?" Then I went down the elevator, got out of the building, and went down the stairs to the servants' quarters in the basement. I don't know how buildings are designed in your country, but in India, every apartment block, every house, every hotel is built with the servants' quarters, sometimes at the back and sometimes, as in the case of Buckingham Towers B block, underground, a warren of interconnected rooms where all the drivers, cooks, sweepers, maids and chefs of the apartment block can rest, sleep and wait. When our masters wanted us, an electric bell began to ring throughout the quarters. We would rush to a board and find a red light flashing next to the number of the apartment whose servant was needed upstairs. I walked down 2 flights of stairs and pushed open the door to the servants' quarters. The moment I got there, the other servants screamed, they yelled, they howled with laughter. The vitiligo-lipped driver was sitting with them, howling the hardest. He had told them the question I had asked him. They could not get over their amusement. Each one of them had to come up to me and force his fingers through my hair and call me a village idiot and slap me on the back too. Servants need to abuse other servants. It's been bred into us, the way Alsatian dogs are bred to attack strangers. We attack anyone who's familiar. There and then I resolved never again to tell anyone in Delhi anything I was thinking, especially not another servant. They kept teasing all evening long, and even at night, when we all went to the dormitory to sleep. Something about my face, my nose, my teeth, I don't know, it got on their nerves. They even teased me about my uniform. See, in cities, the drivers do not wear uniforms. They said I looked like a monkey in that uniform. So I changed into a dirty shirt and trousers like the rest of them. But the teasing, it just went on all night long. There was a man who swept the dormitory, and in the morning I asked him, "Is there some place a man can be alone here?" "There's one empty room on the other side of the quarters, but no one wants it," he told me. "Who wants to live alone?" It was horrible, this room. The floor had not been finished, and there was a cheap whitish plaster on the walls, in which you could see the marks of the hand that had applied the plaster. There was a flimsy little bed, barely big enough even for me, and a mosquito net on top of it. It would do. The second night, I did not sleep in the dormitory. I went to the room. I swept the floor, tied the mosquito net to 4 nails on the wall, and went to sleep. In the middle of the night, I understood why the mosquito net had been left there. Noises woke me up. The wall was covered with cockroaches which had come to feed on the minerals or the limestone in the plaster. Their chewing made a continuous noise, and their antennae trembled from every spot on the wall. Some of the cockroaches landed on top of the net. From inside, I could see their dark bodies against its white weave. I folded in the fibre of the net and crushed one of them. The other roaches took no notice of this. They kept landing on the net and getting crushed. Maybe everyone who lives in the city gets to be slow and stupid like this, I thought, and smiled, and went to sleep. "Had a good night among the roaches," they teased when I came to the common toilet. Any thought I had of rejoining the dormitory ended there. The room was full of roaches, but it was mine, and no one teased me. One disadvantage was that the electric bell did not penetrate this room, but that was a kind of advantage too, I discovered in time. In the morning, after waiting my turn at the common toilet, and then my turn at the common sink, and then my turn at the common bathroom,
I went up one flight of stairs, pushed open the door to the parking lot, and walked to the spot where the Honda City was parked. The car had to be wiped with a soft wet cloth, inside and outside. A stick of incense had to be placed at the small statue of the goddess Lakshmi, goddess of wealth, which sat above the instrument board. This had the double advantage of getting rid of the mosquitoes that had sneaked in at night, and scenting the insides with an aroma of religion. I wiped the seats, nice plush leather seats. I wiped the instruments. I lifted the leather mats on the floor and slapped the dust out of them. There were three magnetic stickers with images of the mother goddess Kali on the dashboard. I had put them there, throwing out Ram Prasad's magnetic stickers. I wiped them all. There was also a small fluffy ogre with a red tongue sticking out of its mouth, hung by a chain from the rear-view mirror. It was supposed to be a lucky charm, and the stork liked to see it bob up and down as we drove. I punched the ogre in the mouth. Then I wiped it clean. Next came the business of checking the box of paper tissues in the back of the car. It was elaborately carved and gilded, like something that a royal family had owned, though it was actually made of cardboard. I made sure there were fresh tissues in the box. Pinky Madam used dozens of tissues each time we went out. She said the pollution in Delhi was so bad. She had left her crushed and crumpled used tissues near the box, and I had to pick them up and throw them out. The electric buzzer sounded through the parking lot. A voice over the lobby microphone said, "Driver Balram, please report to the main entrance of Buckingham B Block with the car." And so it was that I would get into the Honda City, drive up a ramp, and come out to see my first sunlight of the day. The brothers were dressed in posh suits. They were standing at the door to the building, chatting and chirruping when they got in. The mongoose said, "The Congress Party headquarters, Balram. We went there the other day. I hope you remember it and don't get lost again. I'm not going to let you down today, sir." Rush hour in Delhi. Cars, scooters, motorbikes, auto rickshaws, black taxis jostling for space on the road. The pollution is so bad that the men on the motorbikes and scooters have a handkerchief wrapped around their faces. Each time you stop at a red light, you see a row of men with black glasses and masks on their faces, as if the whole city were out on a bank heist that morning. There was a good reason for the face masks. They say the air is so bad in Delhi that it takes 10 years out of a man's life. Of course, those in the cars don't have to breathe the outside air. It is just nice, cool, clean, air-conditioned air for us. With the tinted windows up, the cars of the rich go like dark eggs down the roads of Delhi. Every now and then an egg will crack open. A woman's hand, dazzling with gold bangles, stretches out an open window, flings an empty mineral water bottle onto the road, and then the window goes up and the egg is resealed. I was taking my particular dark egg right into the heart of the city. To my left I saw the domes of the President's House, the place where all the important business of the country is done. When the air pollution is really bad, the building is completely blotted out from the road. But today it shone beautifully. In 10 minutes, I was at the headquarters of the Congress Party. Now, this is an easy place to find, because there are always two or three giant cardboard billboards with the face of Sonia Gandhi outside. I stopped the car, ran out, and opened the door for Mr. Ashok and the mongoose. As he got out, Mr. Ashok said, "We'll be back in half an hour." This confused me. They never told me in Dhanbad when they'd be back. Of course, it meant nothing. They could take 2 hours to come back, or three, but it was a kind of courtesy that they apparently now had to give me because we were in Delhi. A group of farmers came to the headquarters and weren't allowed inside, and shouted something or other and left. A TV van came to the headquarters and honked. They were let in at once. I yawned. I punched the little black ogre in its red mouth, and it bobbed back and forth. I turned my head around from side to side. I looked at the big poster of Sonia Gandhi. She was holding a hand up in the poster, as if waving to me. I waved back. I yawned, closed my eyes, and slithered down my seat. With one eye open, I looked at the magnetic sticker of the goddess Kali, who was a very fierce black-skinned goddess, holding a scimitar and a garland of skulls. I made a note to myself to change that sticker. She looked too much like Granny. 2 hours later, the brothers returned to the car. "We're going to the President's house, Balram, up the hill. You know the place?"
"Yes, sir. I've seen it."
Now, I'd already seen most of the famous sights of Delhi. The House of Parliament, the Janta Manta, the Kutub, but I'd not yet been to this place, the most important one of all. I drove toward Raisina Hill, and then all the way up the hill, stopping each time a guard put his hand out and checked inside the car, and then stopping right in front of one of the big domed buildings around the President's house. "Wait in the car, Balram. We'll be back in 30 minutes. For the first half hour, I was too frightened to get out of the car. I opened the door. I stepped out. I took a look around. Somewhere inside these domes and towers that were all around me, the big men of this country, the Prime Minister, the President, top ministers and bureaucrats, were discussing things and writing them out and stamping papers. Someone was saying, 'There, 500 million rupees for that dam.' And someone was saying, 'Fine, attack Pakistan then.' I wanted to run around shouting, 'Balram is here too! Balram is here too!' I got back into the car to make sure I didn't do anything stupid and get arrested for it. It was getting dark when the two brothers came out of the building. A fat man walked out with them and talked to them for a while, outside the car, and then shook their hands and waved goodbye to us. Mr. Ashok was dark and sullen when he got in. The Mongols asked me to drive them back home, without making any mistakes again, understand?"
"Yes, sir."
They sat in silence, which confused me. If I had just gone into the President's house, I'd roll down the window and shout it aloud to everyone on the road. "Look at that."
"What?"
"That statue." I looked out the window to see a large bronze statue of a group of men. This is a well-known statue, which you will no doubt see in Delhi. At the head is Mahatma Gandhi, with his walking stick, and behind him follow the people of India, being led from darkness to light. The Mongoose squinted at the statue.
"What about it? I've seen it before."
"We're driving past Gandhi, after just having given a bribe to a minister. It's a fucking joke, isn't it?"
"You sound like your wife now," the Mongoose said. "I don't like swearing. It's not part of our traditions here."
But Mr. Ashok was too red in the face to keep quiet.
"It's a fucking joke, our political system, and I'll keep saying it as long as I like."
"Things are complicated in India, Ashok. It's not like in America. Please reserve your judgment."
There was a fierce jam on the road to Gurgaon. Every 5 minutes the traffic would tremble. We'd move a foot, hope would rise, then the red lights would flash on the cars ahead of me, and we'd be stuck again. Everyone honked. Every now and then the various horns, each with its own pitch, blended into one continuous wail that sounded like a calf taken from its mother. Fumes filled the air. Wisps of blue exhaust glowed in front of every headlight. The exhaust grew so fat and thick it could not rise or escape, but spread horizontally, sluggish and glossy, making a kind of fog around us. Matches were continually being struck. The drivers of auto rickshaws lit cigarettes, adding tobacco pollution to petrol pollution. A man driving a buffalo cart had stopped in front of us. A pile of empty car engine oil cans 15 feet high had been tied by rope to his cart. His poor water buffalo, to carry all that load while sucking in this air. The auto rickshaw driver next to me began to cough violently. He turned to the side and spat 3 times in a row. Some of the spit flecked the side of the Honda City. I glared. I raised my fist. He cringed and namaste'd me in apology. "It's like we're in a concert of spitting," Mr. Ashok said, looking at the auto rickshaw driver. "Well, if you were out there breathing that acid air, you'd be spitting like him too," I thought. The cars moved again. We gained 3 feet. Then the red lights flashed and everything stopped again. "In Beijing, apparently, they've got a dozen ring roads. Here we have one. No wonder we keep getting jams. Nothing is planned.
How will we ever catch up with the Chinese? By the way, Mr. Jiabao, 12 ring roads. Wow. Dim streetlights were glowing down onto the pavement on either side of the traffic, and in that orange-hued half-light, I could see multitudes of small, thin, grimy people squatting, waiting for a bus to take them somewhere, or with nowhere to go, and about to unfurl a mattress and sleep right there. These poor bastards had come from the darkness to Delhi to find some light, but they were still in the darkness. Hundreds of them, there seemed to be, on either side of the traffic, and their life was entirely unaffected by the jam. Were they even aware that there was a jam? We were like two separate cities, inside and outside the dark egg. I knew I was in the right city. But my father, if he were alive, would be sitting on that pavement, cooking some rice gruel for dinner, and getting ready to lie down and sleep under a street lamp, and I couldn't stop thinking of that, and recognizing his features in some beggar out there. So I was in some way out of the car, too, even while I was driving it. After an hour of thrashing through the traffic, we got home at last to Buckingham B Block, but the torture wasn't over. As he was getting out of the car, the mongoose tapped his pockets, looked confused for a moment, and said, "I've lost a rupee." He snapped his fingers at me. "Get down on your knees. Look for it on the floor of the car." I got down on my knees. I sniffed in between the mats like a dog, all in search of that one rupee. "What do you mean it's not there? Don't think you can steal from us just because you're in the city. I want that rupee." "We've just paid 500,000 rupees in a bribe, Mukesh, and now we're screwing this man over for a single rupee. Let's go up and have a scotch." "That's how you corrupt servants. It starts with one rupee. Don't bring your American ways here." "Where that rupee coin went remains a mystery to me to this day, Mr. Premier." Finally, I took a rupee coin out of my shirt pocket, dropped it on the floor of the car, picked it up, and gave it to the mongoose. "Here it is, sir. Forgive me for taking so long to find it." There was a childish delight on his dark master's face. He put the rupee coin in his hand and sucked his teeth, as if it were the best thing that had happened to him all day. I took the elevator up with the brothers, to see if any work was to be done in the apartment. Pinky Madam was on the sofa watching TV. As soon as we got in, she said, "I've eaten already," turned the TV off and went into another room. The mongoose said he didn't want dinner, so Mr. Ashok would have to eat alone at the dinner table. He asked me to heat some of the vegetables in the fridge for him, and I went into the kitchen to do so. Casting a quick look back as I opened the fridge door, I saw that he was on the verge of tears. When you're the driver, you never see the whole picture. Just flashes, glimpses, bits of conversation. And then, just when the masters are coming to the crucial part of their talk, it always happens. Some moron in a white jeep almost hits you while trying to overtake a car on the wrong side of the road. You swerve to the side, glare at the moron, curse him silently, and by the time you're eavesdropping again, the conversation in the back seat has moved on, and you never know how that sentence ended. I knew something was wrong, but I hadn't realized how bad the situation had become until the morning Mr. Ashok said to me, "Today you'll drop Mukesh Sir at the railway station, Balram." "Yes, sir," I hesitated. I wanted to ask, just him? Did that mean he was going back for good? Did that mean Pinky Madam had finally got rid of him with her door slamming and tart remarks? At 6 o'clock, I waited with the car outside the entranceway. I drove the brothers to the railway station. Pinky Madam did not come along. I carried the mongoose's bags to the right carriage of the train, then went to a stall and bought a dosa, wrapped in paper for him. That was what he always liked to eat on the train. But I unwrapped the dosa and removed the potatoes, flinging them onto the rail tracks, because potatoes made him fart, and he didn't like that. A servant gets to know his master's intestinal tract from end to end, from lips to anus. The mongoose told me, "Wait, I have instructions for you." I squatted in a corner of the railway carriage.
Balram, you're not in the darkness any longer.
Yes, sir.
There is a law in Delhi.
Yes, sir.
You know those bronze statues of Gandhi and Nehru that are everywhere? The police have put cameras inside their eyes to watch for the cars. They see everything you do. Understand that?
Yes, sir.
Then he frowned, as if wondering what else to say. He said, the air conditioner should be turned off when you are on your own.
Yes, sir.
Music should not be played when you are on your own.
Yes, sir.
At the end of each day, you must give us a reading of the meter to make sure you haven't been driving the car on your own.
Yes, sir.
The mongoose turned to Mr. Ashok and touched him on the forearm. Take some interest in this, Ashok brother. You'll have to check up on the driver when I'm gone. But Mr. Ashok was playing with his cell phone. He put it down and said, the driver's honest. He's from Laxmangar. I saw his family when I went there. Then he went back to his cell phone. Don't talk like that. Don't make a joke of what I'm saying, the mongoose said. But he was paying no attention to his brother. He kept punching the buttons on his cell phone. One minute, I'm talking to a friend in New York. Drivers like to say that some men are first gear types. Mr. Ashok was a classic first gear man. He liked to start things, but nothing held his attention for long. Looking at him, I made two discoveries, almost simultaneously. Each filled me with a sense of wonder. Firstly, you could talk on a cell phone to someone in New York just by punching on its buttons. The wonders of modern science never cease to amaze me. Secondly, I realized that this tall, broad-shouldered, handsome, foreign-educated man, who would be my only master in a few minutes, when the long whistle blew and this train headed off toward Dhanbad, was weak, helpless, absent-minded, and completely unprotected by the usual instincts that run in the blood of a landlord. If you were back in Laxmangar, we would have called you the Lamb. Why are you grinning like a donkey? The mongoose snapped at me, and I almost fell over apologizing to him. That evening at 8 o'clock, Mr. Ashok sent a message to me through another servant. Be ready in half an hour, Balram. Pinky Madam and I will be going out. And the two of them did come down about 2 3/4 of an hour later. The moment the mongoose left, I swear, the skirts became even shorter. When she sat in the back, I could see half her boobs hanging out of her clothes each time I had to look in the rear-view mirror. This put me in a very bad situation, sir. For one thing, my beak was aroused, which is natural in a healthy young man like me. On the other hand, as you know, master and mistress are like father and mother to you, so how can you get excited by the mistress? I simply avoided looking at the rear-view mirror. If there was a crash, it wouldn't be my fault. Mr. Premier, maybe when you have been driving in the thick traffic, you have stopped your car and lowered your window, and then you have felt the hot, panting breath of the exhaust pipe of a truck next to you. Now be aware, Mr. Premier, that there is a hot, panting diesel engine just in front of your own nose. Me. Each time she came in with that low, black dress, my beak got big. I hated her for wearing that dress, but I hated my beak even more for what it was doing.